Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall Taylor.
I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Just under a year since the Turkish presidential elections, in which President Erdogan won another 5 years in power, last week's local election results delivered a harsh blow to Erdogan and the ruling Justice and Development Party, or the AKP. Although the gap at the national level wasn't huge, the Republican People's Party, or the CHP, won about 38% compared to about 35% for Erdogan's AKP. In major Turkish cities, the gulf was significant. In Istanbul, Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu won 51% of the vote compared to 39% for his AKP rival. And in Ankara, the incumbent CHP mayor beat his AKP challenger by 29 percentage points. Furthermore, after CHP's disappointing results in last year's general election, no one had expected the party to achieve more than 30% of the vote nationwide and give the AKP its worst defeat since it was founded in 2001. To discuss how we should interpret these election results and their implications for Turkish democracy, we're very pleased to have back with us Stephen Cook and Asla Aydın-Denenbaş with us on the podcast. Stephen and Asla, I hope I didn't slaughter your last name too badly this time, but welcome back to you both.
You did Cook very well. You pronounced Cook extremely well. Thank you,
Stephen. I've been practicing.
I feel we need another election to perfect this. Andrea.
I know we'll get there eventually. Some of us learn more slowly than others. Asla, maybe we'll start with you. I mean, I think the big question that I have, it's just been under a year since the presidential election. And what changed? Why did it change so quickly? Was this a delayed reaction to the economic situation, or were there other factors at play? What happened?
So, Andrea, I think this was the project that opposition started at the last election, trying to broaden their base above and beyond urban secularists, but they failed to accomplish their objectives in the last election, in large part because of the leadership factor, something we've talked about last time Steve and I spoke, that they ended up fielding a relatively lackluster candidate. And now you had two things happening. For economic reasons, Erdogan's support base decided to penalize him by staying home, not showing out to vote. And secondly, I think the opposition was finally able to build a broader urban coalition and sort of not just be a party of the urban elites or middle class and secularists, but try to get the Kurdish vote, but achieved in getting Kurdish and some conservative vote. That is in large part because it fielded better candidates in the two mayors of Istanbul and Ankara are now pretty well known, not just in Turkey, but beyond, but in other places too. So this was simultaneously a protest vote because of the economic situation from Erdogan's base, and an achievement on part of the opposition to build a big tent. Big tent politics has to be the future of Turkey. And while Erdogan is narrowing down his base with the far right and farther right coalitions he's building, opposition is expanding its base.
Stephen, what would you add?
Well, I think I concur with what Asla says here, and I'd underline the fact that leadership matters. If Ekrem İmamoğlu, who is the mayor of Istanbul, who has now beaten Erdogan by proxy three times in a row, had perhaps been the opposition's presidential candidate in May 2023, we might be talking about a different Turkey. But of course, we can't, we can't go back in time and see what would happen. Besides the fact, and I think, the economic issue is obviously very, very important, but there's one other thing I think is important. Erdogan and the AKP have been in power now almost 22 years. And it's been a long time since the AKP offered Turks a positive vision for their future. Erdogan has become kind of this hectoring, threatening presence in the lives of people. And it may very well be that this election, especially after there was, some questions about how the presidential election was conducted, and that people have just grown tired of Erdogan and the AKP, and either perhaps part of the base stayed home, and that motivated more people to show up and vote for the CHP. It's rather extraordinary results. The opposition flipped 15 municipalities and held on to Ankara in this decisive way. Mansour Yavaş, the opposition mayor of Ankara, won by, as you pointed out, 29 points. That's extraordinary. And of course, İmamoğlu won by a significant margin as well. So I would add to Asla's analysis about economics, about leadership mattering, to the tantalizing idea that people are just sick of Erdogan.
So is this a turning point, do you think? I mean, is this the beginning of something? Was it just the confluence of factors that you both have pointed out coming together, the fruition of the work, the Asla that you talked about, this project that had been started? Is it just kind of a convergence of these factors and, you know, this was an anomaly, or do you see this as something really different and a potentially new trajectory for Turkey moving forward?
Well, I don't think everyone's going to give it up so easily, right? He still wants to remain in power and wants to continue the transformation of Turkey and wants to write a new constitution. But it seems clear that for the first time, I think, since the AKP came to power, that one can imagine an opposition politician becoming the president. Now, of course, İmamoğlu still faces a court case that would prevent him from either serving his term or running for president in the future. But if you see İmamoğlu, if you see Yavaş, you see politicians who could chart a non-Erdogan, non-AKP AKP future. I think this is the first time where that's a realistic possibility.
Also, I want you to come in too, but Stephen, just remind me, is it what that, going back to the presidential election, was İmamoğlu not able to run? I'm forgetting what happened.
Well, after the 2019 local elections, he is alleged to have insulted the members of the High Election Council, and the prosecutors brought a case against him, the result of which could be his banning from politics. That he was found guilty. That case is now on appeal. Okay. And we don't obviously know the disposition of it yet.
But is that what prohibited him from running, or was it something?
Well, I think that the previous candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who had long been the leader of the CHP, insisted that it was his turn to run, which was a mistake.
Great. Okay, Asla, turning point or not?
Well, it's not a game changer at this point in the short run, in the sense that Erdogan is still the president of Turkey, firmly in charge, and the next general elections are not scheduled for another 4 years. They are scheduled for 2028. But I do think it is a significant it is a significant event that will change Turkish politics in the medium term. By medium term, let's qualify that, a couple of years. I think soon we're going to see, as Stephen has said, İmamoğlu and Yavaş, these leaders emerging. İmamoğlu is most likely going to be the de facto leader of the opposition camp. That is the very popular mayor of Istanbul. And this is a real threat to Erdogan, because with this economic situation, and we're talking about 65 to 70% inflation, with a younger and more charismatic opposition figure, or more than one, in fact, what you're going to see is within a year or so, the opposition will start asking for early elections. Now, for an American audience, early elections doesn't mean anything, because elections take place every year. But it's very common in Europe, more common in some countries like Italy than others. But early elections are when the government can no longer sustain the pressure to keep ruling and stick to the original date, when they feel the need to go to the polls and maintain and renew confidence of the voter. And Erdogan might be forced to do that in a couple of years. He may not have the sort of long 4 years of tranquility that he thinks he has. Of course, a lot will change. And of course, it's too early to write Erdogan off. He may rekindle some of the support he has, base, he's rekindle relations with his base. He could double down. He could do a deal with the Kurds and so on and so forth. He's really a magician of sorts when it comes to elections and electoral space. But right now, the direction of travel is, I think, very clear, and it's away from Erdogan for all types of reasons. We've talked about economy, you know, that he's been in power for 22 years and the opposition doing well, and also generational issues. It's a young country. I think the median age is something like 28. And Erdogan is past his 70. He's in coalition with a leader who's past his 70, the ultra-nationalist leader. And, you know, I think people want to see eventually a shift in power to the 50-something generation, which was Erdogan's original promise 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
I think here in the U.S., we can sympathize with a similar dynamic.
Exactly.
I know Jim wants to get in a question, but really quickly, I mean, I think we all agree after 22 years in power, you said it, Stephen, he's not going to give it up easily. And so how do you both expect Erdogan to respond to the setback? He obviously, Asla, you were talking about, is going to see İmamoğlu as an increasing threat. So what do you expect from him in the coming years in terms of tools, tactics, things that he'll do in order to kind of push back against this changing tide that you're talking about? And in there, the Constitution, because that was definitely a question. When, you know, with the setback, do you think he'll still try to introduce a new Constitution? So talk to me about what you think he's got up his sleeve after facing this setback.
I'll let Asla go and then play cleanup.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, Erdogan is an interesting politician, and on the election night, he surprised everybody by saying, I hear what you're saying. We will boldly engage in self-criticism and so on, this very conciliatory message. He is thinking. He's thinking of what to do, and he has a number of options. I think doubling down on sort of more hardline policies is no longer an option. Personally, that's what I think, but Turkey always surprises you. What he's going to try is probably try to reap the benefits of this new economic program he has started. For the past couple of years, Erdogan ran the country with something that could be called Erdoganomics, his own economic ideas and theories, and that's really hit rock bottom with super high inflation and essentially Turkey being bankrupt. And he's brought in, about last summer, he's brought in a new economy czar and given him enormous powers, which you have. And what is partly the issue for him in this election is a belt tightening, some type of an austerity program, not too harsh, but harsh enough that people feel it. And I think his plan will be to wait it out for a year or two, hoping that in a year they will be able to rein in inflation and start reaping the benefits of this program. If that doesn't happen, then, you know, he will entertain other options, including trying to see if he can do something with the Kurds or maybe the legal options that he's hinted before with İmamoğlu. But there are hardline and the opposite, softer options that I think he will decide on. But first, he will have to put the economy in order, and that will be, at best, in a year or year and a half. So back to Steve, maybe.
I think the one surprising thing to me about the immediate post-elections was that Erdogan actually spoke on election night. He usually disappears into the presidential palace and pouts for a few days and plots his strategy before coming out and saying anything. And it was striking that he made these kind of conciliatory remarks. Of course, within 24 hours, the authorities were trying to block the duly elected mayor of the city of Van, a Kurd from the Kurdish-based Dem Party, from taking office. He had beaten his AKP opposition, you know, by almost double the amount of votes. And that didn't work. Actually, atypically, the Higher Election Council had a spine and said, no, this guy is actually elected. And I think that you'll see, I think Ashley makes a really good point. You know, Erdogan is not in any political jeopardy himself as the president. So why not ride perhaps a new economic track? If that bears fruit and people start to benefit, it could only help him politically because he's still the guy in charge. But I also expect that he will pursue these legal challenges to İmamoğlu's viability in order to weaken him. Erdogan is a shrewd politician, and he is deeply paranoid, which makes him a good politician as well. So I don't think he'll leave much to chance. So indeed, the legal avenues against İmamoğlu, I'm not convinced of conciliation with Kurds. I think that that's an avenue that he tried once before, but created problems for himself on his nationalist right. So I think it's possible for him to pursue more orthodox economic policies while continuing to pursue nationalist policies at home and legal policies to undermine his opposition, all in the name of continuing AKP rule and ultimately getting that constitution that he wants, which will lock in the changes that the AKP has made over the course of these last two decades. And that's ultimately his goal. If he is looking towards his legacy, the real only way to seal his legacy is through a constitution. It's somewhat harder for him to do it right now, given it seemed the electoral outcomes. But overall, the parties are not that far apart. He does seem like he might need more of a mandate, though, to really fully alter the constitution in ways that he has wanted to before, but's never been able to do it.
Do we know what's in the constitutional changes that we made? Or we're not there yet?
No, we're not there yet.
Okay.
But we do know that,
we
do know that some of his people have tested the waters to talk about lifting the term limits. Because technically speaking, this is Erdogan's, second term, but really third
depends
term.
Depends on how you count, right?
Maybe depends on how you count. That's a long story. But technically speaking, this is his last term,
right,
according to the current constitution.
Which expires, remind us?
His term expires 2028.
Okay. All right. So he has a little time. If he is seeking to remove term limits, he's got some time.
So Erdogan's dilemma, I mean, I think the choice he has is whether to, seek a lifetime presidency a la Putin or Xi Jinping, or actually sort of think of his place in history and legacy and so on, and try to, not go down as the strong man who sought lifetime.
I will point out that he has said that he would be there until he goes to his grave. So,
well,
I mean, things change. People change their mind, but he has said that.
Well, what do you think? What kind of Erdogan is going to visit Washington? What will be in his mind when he comes to D.C.? Is he going to be a legacy Erdogan when he's going to come and he's going to offer suggestions about the S-400 and he's going to be real reasonable about how to talk about the YPG, and he's going to, is that going to be the Erdogan, or is it going to be an Erdogan who's going to be a bit combative and trying to score some easy points for his base back at home? And so what kind of Erdogan are we going to see? Someone that's wants to make friends, or are we going to see someone who's going to come and it's going to be, not as good as it maybe should be if we really want to try to repair the relationship?
And I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I think that it's entirely possible. First of all, this is a reward for giving the thumbs up to Sweden's entry into NATO. And Erdogan has long wanted an Oval Office meeting. And this was the price, was saying yes to Sweden. And I think that Erdogan, when he relates to the presidents that he's worked with, he has often said to them, look, Turkey is your best ally here. We can work constructively, give up the YPG. We are fighting ISIS. We are on the front lines against Russia. We are, you know, this relationship, if you only saw things the way we saw them, this could be a productive relationship. Of course, the devil is always in the details. And it's not always, the Turks have not always been as constructive as they have made themselves out to be. But it's certainly the case that he will talk that way with President Biden. What his public statements are, how the Turkish press reports on the visit, how he criticizes the administration, whether explicitly or implicitly, on a variety of issues, whether it is YPG, whether it is the handling of the war in Gaza Strip, it remains to be seen. But it is often the case that there is this kind of private diplomatic conversation where the Turks, you know, emphasize the importance of the relationship and a reset in the relationship, whereas public comments would suggest that the relationship is as difficult as it has been from time to time.
Asla, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think this is an important visit. It could be an important visit, or it could be actually not much. I have a feeling that Erdogan wants to fix the relationship with the West, in part because he's got the sort of the scene that we've talked about at home, a rising Imamoglu and an economic situation. And so he'll, based on what I have observed in sort of the various trips by the Turkish foreign minister, Hakan Fidan, I think there will be a more constructive tone. Now, that doesn't mean he's coming with a solution for S-400s or is going to align with the U.S. on YPG. I think those two issues will continue to be, there will continue to be misalignment on those. But I think the economic situation, and in fact the election results, means that U.S. has greater leverage when it comes to dealing with Erdogan. But the question is, what does it want to use this opening for, and what does U.S. want to use this opening for? Can there be? I think reset is very strong, but can there be a new relationship, a new beginning of some sort, a different type of relationship? Can there be greater cooperation on Ukraine, for example? I hear a lot about potential, the idea of Turkish-US cooperation on Africa and Central Asia. Is that just a talking point that sounds nice to, when you talk to media, or is there anything to it? So, you know, these are some of the interesting questions about this trip. I think Steve's, I want to hear what Steve has to say on this issue also, really, but I just want to say one last comment is, living in Washington, I don't see a huge enthusiasm about Erdogan's trip from the administration. It seems to be, okay, we promised him there would be a White House visit if Turks say yes on Sweden. That seems to be sort of ticking a box. But is there more to it? Can there be more to it? Sorry, Steve.
Yeah, I think there's about 12 people in Washington who are really interested in Erdogan's visit. And Ashley and I are
here.
Asa and I are two of the most interested in it. So sure. I certainly agree that the administration seems ambivalent about it. I just wonder whether the election results and the economy, I wonder what leverage the United States really has with Turkey and to what end. I think essentially the administration's policy has been to try to create an environment where the Turks undercut American foreign policy less than previously, which is not necessarily a wonderful starting point. I also want to point out that President Biden puts a lot of stock in his personal relationship with other leaders. We see that playing out over and over again, most recently with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And these President Erdogan and President Biden are known not to necessarily get along in the same way that perhaps President Erdogan got along with President Trump or even President Obama for the first part of Obama's first term, and actually into his second term. So it's not really warm at the top in the way that it had been, despite difficulties in the relationship, which might make it might make the visit more of a challenge. I suspect it's going to be a visit. It's not going to be some sort of kind of breakthrough important type of thing.
One thing I've been wondering is the way how Turkey is experiencing its foreign policy, meaning the war in Ukraine is now past its second year. And in the Middle East, that conflict there has passed its 6-month mark, and there's still a very real risk of further escalation. How is that being felt in Ankara by Turkish people? Is there the deepening military relationship between Russia and Iran? How are these things being felt, responded to? Does it have an impact? I mean, Asla, maybe you can start, you know, with your sense of how people, Turkish people, are experiencing all of this turmoil all around Turkey.
Well, there's two reflexes. One is very strong anti-Western sentiment that has also been promoted by the government. The West is doesn't have your best interests, is trying to divide up Turkey, is supporting terrorists, they're responsible for the war in Ukraine, provoked Russia, so on and so forth. This is sort of across the board, even in some opposition circles, not all, but even in some opposition circles. So anti-Westernism. Secondly, a desire for stability and balancing act. For better or worse, I think Erdogan has convinced Turkish public that balancing act among great powers is the way to survive this period. And so people are not giving him a hard time about one day, fighting with Sisi and then the next day going over and shaking his hand and trying to, you know, sell weapons to Ukraine and then doing a pipeline deal with Putin. I think that it's a bit, they have a totally cynical understanding of foreign affairs and do seem to think that multipolarity, offers Turkey opportunities. So people are very, very conscious of the fact that there are two major wars going on, and there could even be a regional war in the Middle East. That is largely something Erdogan is able to use and milk, to be honest, because in rough times, you do want a captain that could, that an experienced captain. On the other hand, you also want not to starve. So I think in the last election, these national security concerns, I am experienced, I can handle international affairs, I can play ball with these, strong men around Turkey and with Western powers, was important. In this election, it's been 8 months after that, people say, yes, national security is important, but I need bread. I need to be able to feed my family. So it's Erdogan's strength is international relations. I think his weakness is the economy. And it's a question of where the society will go. I'm talking too much, but I want to go to Stephen. But there's a comment from a street interview that I remember from last election. He said, one guy who was interviewed on the street said, look, we knew the world was on fire and Turkey's neighborhood is on fire. And we were also getting less and less food for our salary, but between choosing our country and being able to afford onions, we picked our country. So the opposition will be successful to the extent that they can disrupt the society of the notion that you need Erdogan for Turkey to survive, and you actually, on top, you can also have better better, you know, better lives.
Stephen.
I think it's been clear that Erdogan and the AKP have sought strategic autonomy in its foreign policy, that there are certain benefits of being aligned to the West, but that Turkey's national interests are served by also cultivating ties with Putin's Russia, more recently the Chinese, as well as positioning Turkey as a leader in the Middle East and the Muslim world. So that's been very, very clear for quite some time. That isn't just a function of this moment in Turkish foreign policy and politics. And by and large, that has not been the fight in Turkish politics. I think people generally like the idea that Turkey is autonomous and can pursue, calculate its own interests and pursue its interests, regardless of what people think in Washington or Brussels or Moscow or whatnot. The fight has been about domestic politics, authoritarianism, the economy, cultural issues. So in terms of how Turks are responding to the conflicts around them, early on in the conflict in Ukraine, large majorities of Turks blame NATO for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I don't think that has significantly changed. When it comes to the war in the Gaza Strip, the government has really whipped up a lot of pro-Hamas sentiment. The government has said, Hamas is not a terrorist organization. Erdogan has engaged in kind of really crude anti-Semitic behavior. I mean, has called Benjamin Netanyahu worse than Hitler because he's richer. I mean, you can't hit on more like awful types of trips than those. Of course, in the Israeli press, not long after the election results were announced in Turkey, there was some reporting that Turkish diplomats were reaching out to their Israeli counterparts to see how they can kind of repair relations, which is a pattern in Turkish politics and foreign policy. But overall, Turkish public has long been sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. And so, I think people are deeply affected by that conflict in particular.
Jim, I was waiting for you to jump on the NATO references.
Well, I'm so tired of talking about Turkey and NATO that I was trying to think of something else. And what I was going to ask actually is how successful has Erdogan been in terms of trying to spread his influence into North Africa and Egypt, Armenia, Azerbaijan? I know that he's got a lot of pots to stir, and he's been stirring the NATO pot. Andre is absolutely right. But his real focus has been to really try to win back a lot of the regional influence that Turkey used to have in years past, some way past. And how has that been going? That's another legacy for Erdogan. Has that gone anywhere? Iran, Egypt, that type of outlook.
There's been some polling recently that demonstrates that Erdogan's popularity among Arab publics has been consistently favorable. But in terms of the actual Turkish influence, the influence of the Turkish government and Turkey, I think in places like Egypt, across North Africa, it's perhaps not as great as I think the investment that Erdogan had previously made in establishing influence there. Primarily, he did it through the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist parties, which have been on the run. The coup or the kind of self-coup, the palace coup, however you want to describe it, in Tunisia undermined the Ennahda party in Tunisia, where Erdogan had good ties. Obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, going back to the coup in Egypt in 2013, undermined his position in North Africa's largest country by population. So I think where Turkey previously had kind of both certain cultural as well as economic interests and influence, I don't see it as great as it once was. And I haven't seen it as important as it was perhaps prior to the Arab uprisings. In the last decade or so, it's really diminished. Although Erdogan's, you know, forthright denunciations of Israeli conduct and the Israeli prime minister certainly wins him support among Arab publics.
Asla, feel free to add to that, but I'd also love to hear you talk a little bit about the Caucasus in Central Asia. I mean, one of the things, you know, we're thinking a lot about is as some of these countries, Armenia, Moldova, some countries in Central Asia are more wary and skeptical of Russia's role in the region. Is Turkey viewing that as an opportunity? And do they have kind of the capacity to capitalize on any openings?
Yeah, I mean, capacity is certainly an issue that we can debate that, whether Turkey has the capacity or not. But they are seeing an opening in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, I think in parts of Africa also, to push in and sort of be a player in a way that almost can push back Russia's economic influence. And this is going to be his ultimate proposition to Washington when he comes here. There are issues where U.S. and Turkey cannot align, but then could we do more in Africa, in Central Asia, in Caucasus, and so on? I think that will be, you know, in more crude terms, Turks will be telling U.S. support us in Africa, so we push back against Wagner in Central Africa and some of these Muslim countries Turkey has influence. So Turkey, Erdogan is popular in the Middle East, and Turkey did have a fair amount of soft power and trade openings. And I think over the past couple of years, President Erdogan has traded that for hard power, selling drones, doing military incursions at the cost of, ruining Turkey's relations with UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, and so on. So he's somewhere, he's now been rolling back from that policy, but still has a fair amount of, Turkey still has its military footprint in parts of Middle East and Africa. It's still trying to be a security provider, not in the same way as Russia, but trying. So I think the question will be, can it align itself with the U.S. and would the U.S. be interested in that proposition and opening the path for Turkey to have greater presence? The Caucasus, South Caucasus particularly, is provides an opening that Turkey has not yet taken. There, the issue is the potential peace treaty between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which the West is supporting, and Azeris are not really taking at this point. The draft is ready, the texts are ready, everything is ready. And Turkey is hands off because they don't want to push Azerbaijan into accepting it. It would be really good for Turkey if there was peace between Armenia and Azerbaijan. That effectively opens an entire trade route all the way into Central Asia directly from Turkey. And it also provides economic livelihood for Armenia, which is truly struggling and landlocked, but also extremely vulnerable, as we know from the last two Azeri incursions. If that deal was to happen, if Erdogan was to play a constructive role, in other words, if it was able to lean into Azerbaijan and say, do accept a peace treaty with Armenia, that would go a long way. Strategically, economically, it would help Turkey's east and also Armenia immensely. And I think it would win him a good deal of brownie points. But Erdogan is not in the business of winning brownie points. You know, every time you say to yourself, you know, it would be great if he released Osman Kavala. It would be great if he did this. It would be great if he actually, you know, invited Armenian leader and Azeri leadership. He's not in that popularity contest in the way we think he should be. So the Caucasus, South Caucasus is extremely fragile. the way I see it, Armenia and Azerbaijan could sign a peace deal or there could be another war. And I worry that it could happen during the U.S. election cycle here. So a lot depends on Turkey and whether or not Erdogan can have a different tone, a more constructive tone after his visit to Washington. That, of course, depends on whether or not President Biden wants to ask Erdogan to help. And of course, you know, in any issue where people talk about a trade-off with Turkey or asking Turkey to do this, then the second thought is, well, if we ask Erdogan to do this, then he's going to ask for what? You know, it's not easy to deal with President Erdogan. But I think it is becoming essential, at least for Turkey's immediate neighborhood, to seek ways where there could be greater alignment.
Stephen, I know we lose you to the airport soon, so maybe you can add to what Asla said, but maybe through the form of a last question on like what a U.S. policy on Turkey should look like. I mean, what are the areas that you're most concerned about where they could undermine interests, and where could we be aligned in productive ways? Like what would be your ideal approach to Turkey, you know, even coming up with this meeting in May?
What should be in Biden's talking points?
Yeah. What should be in Biden's talking points? Well, first, I'll just defer to Asla on the South Caucasus, who she's far better equipped to answer those questions than I am. I think in terms of what is it that we want from Turkey, I mean, you know, my view is that the country is neither a friend nor a foe of the United States. And then there are particular areas where our interests intersect and overlap, where we could do productive things together, perhaps in Africa, perhaps encountering the Wagner group, perhaps in the Black Sea. But of course, you know, Erdogan is a wild card and calculates his own interests. Places where I think that it's important to draw a line with Erdogan are certainly in Syria, certainly in Ukraine. As helpful as the Turks might have been at the start, once the United States and the Europeans really got going on this, the Turks have sort of taken a secondary role here and, of course, opened up this channel with the Russians. If we're very, very serious about wanting to prevent Vladimir Putin from prevailing, we have to close ranks. And Turkey has been a channel for Putin. So I think that's something that the president very much needs to read President Erdogan. I don't know if the Riot Act, but make it very, very clear in no uncertain terms that playing both ends of the stick are not no longer acceptable. And finally, you know, the president came into office making a very big deal about American values in American foreign policy. He dropped it within a couple of months. It's clear that it's no longer a priority, but Turkey is quite repressive. Ashla mentioned, you know, Turkey's perhaps the most well-known political dissident in jail, Osman Kavala. But there are many, many others. There's thousands upon thousands of opponents of Erdogan in Turkey's jails. I have long been a proponent of publicly calling the Turks out on this. Administration after administration has preferred to handle these issues in a private way and have put human rights, made human rights secondary to the larger strategic issues. I think that, you know, there's room for it in the conversation between the two presidents.
Also, would you add anything to the talking points last bit?
I do agree. The administration has decided to drop human rights in the bilateral relationship in part because it's just so strained in every other way. Some people would like greater emphasis on human rights. And then there's another school of thought that says human rights can improve if Turkey is closer to the West. I am of the feeling at this point in my life that human rights improves in Turkey as a result of domestic dynamics,
right.
Internal dynamics, very little that people could do externally. And I'm hoping that, you know, internal dynamics will keep eventually see, we'll see an opening, whether it's under Erdogan or not, most likely not. But other than that, yeah, I agree with what much of Stephen has said. The one difference is I think Turkey could be more helpful on Ukraine, particularly in the defense industrial production, since there is a crunch when it comes to weapons supply and high tech and low end and ammunition and missiles and everything. We're talking about NATO's second largest military and one that is combat proven. So there could be a greater opening maybe than what we have right now.
I know we're at the very end and Stephen's got to get off to the airport, but one last question, lightning round, which is, what is the one deliverable you want to see from this visit coming up? Stephen, what's the one deliverable you want from this visit?
No harm.
Well,
no harm. I just want us to everybody come out of this meeting with nobody getting beaten up in the streets of Washington, D.C., no crisis in the world. This is one less thing. So just if it remains status quo, that's fine. If it gets a little bit better, that's great too. But let's not have a crisis with Turkey.
Asli?
I think that's a good one. No harm would be an improvement because right. Every other interaction has been sort of explosive. Probably Turkish side would want an economic messaging of sorts. Any type of economic pronouncement would go down well. And, you know, I would like to see perhaps, an agreement to keep talking extensively, more extensively on Caucasus, and really and really would like to see as sort of a potential quick win President Biden asking Erdogan to weigh in on the peace negotiations between Armenia and Azerbaijan. I think it's in Turkey's long-term interest to sort of support the resilience and independence of these two republics, and Turkey can, but I think would only do so if there is an ask. And that may not be a bad idea.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. I mean, I think I do very much worry about the ripple effects of the war and potential flashpoints in and around Russia's borders. And certainly with Moldova, Armenia, Azerbaijan, there's lots of ways that things could get bad. And Turkey, I agree, could be productive in that.
Yeah. So,
a great one. Well, as always, it's been a very enjoyable conversation. Love having the two of you together to talk Turkey, and look forward to the next time we get to do it.
It's a great pleasure to be here with you guys.
Good to be with you guys.
Talk soon.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Brussels Sprouts, brought to you by the Transatlantic Security Team at the Center for a New American Security. You can find all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please remember to rate and review Brussels Sprouts so that new listeners are able to find the show.